This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Ray McGovern, let me start with you. So we have a list of the President-elect Trump's picks that we're going to pick apart, so to speak. And I put Mike Huckabee as the first choice here. Would you like to start with that one or not? I can go down the list. Which one do you think ranks higher?
I'm already quite depressed by that list. Let me explain, though, why I have a keffiyeh on. I do not represent any outlet or even my own website. I am an American. I am appalled at our genocide. And so I'm remembering the words of Archbishop Tutu, who said, "He who remains neutral in times like these has chosen the side of the oppressor. I choose the side of not the oppressor." In answer to your question with respect to Mike Huckabee, he is the epitome of an ignorant Christian Zionist who thinks that God is a real estate agent and has given territory long occupied by Palestine to the Jewish people. There could not be a more crass or more, a more dumb pick for ambassador to Israel than Huckabee, but he, of course, follows a long line of such people. And Trump, I guess the only saving grace, the only slice of hope, in my view, is that Elon Musk met with Iran's ambassador to the UN earlier this week. I don't know what they discussed, but I'm hopeful that early reports that Musk was trying to tamp down the possibility that, for example, Iran would start working on a nuclear weapon rather than just nuclear material. I hope that Iran will not rise to the bait here and give Bibi Netanyahu a pretext to do worse than he has already done.
Yeah, that's not a line, even though much has been in the news about that Iran has confirmed. But I find it interesting that our guest star, Ashish Prashar, talked about the keffiyeh. And he brought about the notion that should be the theme of the whole Palestine issue at this point, which is the genocide taking place. And I'd like to ask you how it is that you have these picks, of which many are what's called evangelical Christians. And as a Christian, a religion that's supposed to promote peace, that they are supporting a genocide. And we do have to go through some of these picks, mind you, but I was going to do that at the end of the program, but I'm going to start off with that, because some of them are just that. But then how is it that you can be a Christian and support this genocide?
Well, so I have a slightly different view to my colleague on this. I just think Trump holds a mirror up to America, right? Does policy change because of these individuals who he's appointed? He's just showing the true ugly nature of American foreign policy with picks like Marco Rubio, Elise Stefanik, and frankly, all of them. Like you said, Mike Huckabee. I mean, the guy has no clue about foreign policy or anything else. But he's a Christian Zionist. But he's showing the true face of American foreign policy for all its ugly red for the last 50, 60 years. The reality is that, you know, just because someone like Anthony Blinken went to the right schools or plays a guitar with Bruce Springsteen, is he less of a war criminal or a dangerous person than Marco Rubio and those comments he made about kids in Gaza? You know, if you think about someone like Blinken, for example, who's been our Secretary of State, is still, by the way, our Secretary of State, it could end this, his grandfather founded the American Palestinian Institute, an organization that, you know, furthered the Zionist colonial project. He also said Obama failed in Syria because he didn't bomb Syria out of existence. And this is a guy who's been a warmonger his whole life and been anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian. But because he didn't say some offhand comments or isn't as racist publicly, is he any better than Marco Rubio or any of the other members of these picks that Trump's made in the last few days? Yes, people probably are looking to Trump to do something differently. All he's doing is showing America for what it is. You know, people are worried about, because of Mike Huckabee and Marco Rubio, that there's going to be annexation of the West Bank. Can you tell me, from President Obama through to President Trump and, again, Joe Biden, has anyone tried to stop the annexation of the West Bank, which has been going on for the last decade and a bit? I mean, the aggressiveness has definitely turned up under the Biden administration. But, you know, the only reason we've seen the Biden administration put some sanctions on settlers is because Gaza had focused on it. People were annexing the West Bank and settling on it in all the way up to October 7th, and the administration did nothing because it kind of approved of it. Trump will just annex it. That's the difference. He's going to show the ugly face of American foreign policy with these picks, but also his own policy. Now, I do agree with Ray that I don't think he wants boots on the ground. I don't think he wants a war with Iran. He doesn't want to get dragged into something because his base definitely is less of a, it's definitely got an anti-war element in it. And I believe that he will do everything to avert that because he wants to be this great peacemaker. And a little bit of this reminds me of when Reagan took office after Jimmy Carter. And a lot, and this is all publicly disclosed now, but Reagan's back-channeling with Iran on that was okay. To keep the hostages in place. And Reagan then had them released on Inauguration Day. So Trump, I feel like on Inauguration Day, wants some big wins, right? Similar to Reagan. Maybe he wants Bibi to temper it down. Maybe he says there's not going to be any more aggression. It might be temporary because Bibi's ambitions.
Sure.
But I think he wants a big win in the region early in his picks.
Let's pick up on that point about the annexation of the occupied West Bank, Ray McGovern. I mean, is there anything left there for annexation, or is it annexed already and we're just really dealing with what has been an unfortunate result of the U.S. policy allowing Israel to do that? Because Mike Huckabee has said the full Israeli annexation of the occupied West Bank will be possible under the next Trump administration. He chose his words carefully there. Do you think that it's going to happen, Ray McGovern?
Well, Trump blessed the Israeli annexation of the Golan Heights against all international law. What's to prevent him from blessing the annexation of the West Bank, except for the fact that there were more than a million Palestinians living there? It's gotten worse. But unless Israel is prepared to exterminate, to do genocide in the West Bank as well, and unless it's enabled to do that by, I'm sorry to say, our country, the United States of America, well, if that happens, then, Bibi Netanyahu will have achieved his aim. Now, I would kind of emphasize this fact. Netanyahu militarily is losing on all fronts. Gaza? Lebanon, he's losing the battle within his government. I don't know how long he's going to last, and so this is not good news, as it would appear apparently at first blush. He's desperate. What will he do? Well, my guess is that he will advertise that Iran is now working on a nuclear weapon, and that in just 2 weeks' time, they will have one, and so Israel has to do a preemptive attack. What will Trump and his cronies, his Zionist and Christian Zionist cronies, do at that point? That's the real problem. Now, what I hope that Elon Musk learned from Iran's ambassador at the UN is that Iran has not reversed the fatwa against nuclear weapons, that has no intention of doing that, and that the pretext that likely Netanyahu is going to raise is based, as usual, on false facts. So let's hope that's the case. Let's hope that Trump really doesn't want to get involved in a war with Iran. And let's hope, most of all, that the people he has now appointed won't mousetrap him, and Bibi Netanyahu will not mousetrap him into a situation where he feels he has to come to Israel's aid, no matter genocide, no matter what.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'm going to push that down a little bit further into the program to get into that topic, since we have to discuss at least a little bit more than just one of those picks. And my next pick here is Elsie Stefanik, the pick for the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. And actually, I'd like to get your, reaction to that. What I find from her that's very interesting is that she has said the U.S. should supply Israel with what it needs, when it needs it, without conditions, in order to achieve a total victory. It kind of overlaps some of the other picks also. And the deduction made there is that she supports the U.S.-Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. Do you read it that way also?
I mean, yes. I mean, if you go down 98% of Congress, I'm sure you'd find half of them are funded by AIPAC, and the rest of them have pledged some sort of form of allegiance to Israel by saying it has the right to self-defense, and we'll keep funding the Iron Dome, pass these $25 billion. I mean, some of it's been passed by the executive office, but, you know, has not blocked any of the weapons transfers. I think she's just on par with every other American, American in the Senate or Congress right now. The reality is that she, again, says it out loud. She says her opinion. I think she's been rewarded for doing the overreach of an anti-Semitism witch hunt in the United States, where she bullied university presidents and professors into to shutting down, you know, peaceful camps in solidarity with the Palestinians on college campuses. And that's what she's been rewarded with, a position that, frankly, to me, is meaningless in the UN. I mean, the US has basically said that they're not going to listen to the UN on anything. She's been rewarded with a diplomatic position that looks high profile in its rank. But, you know, the UN has been a powerless body since Iraq. The illegal Iraq invasion, and I believe she's just been rewarded. I don't think she's going to have any real say over anything similar to Nikki Haley or Linda Greenfield right now. I think they just literally are a token diplomat. So it's a lot of verbiage. It's a lot of, I think, Trump giving his biggest funder what she wants, Miriam Edelson, who's donated $100-odd million to his campaign. She could not have dreamed better picks with Rubio, Huckabee, Elise, and others. I mean, this is her perfect cabinet. But I still think foreign policy will still run through Trump, similar to his first term. I think he wants to build his own reputation, quote unquote legacy, whatever that means nowadays to politicians. But I think a lot of his decision making, similar to when he engaged with North Korea and everything, is his decision making.
Sure.
It's not going to be these people. And I'll give you another example quickly on this. This is Rubio. Everyone worries that Marco Rubio is going to start like a war or even a trade war with China. A lot of that is rhetoric, and the reason I'll bring that to this conversation quickly is that, you know, a lot of people talked about the Trump transition team. It involves his chief of staff, Susie Wiles. It involves J.D. Vance. It involves Howard Lutnick. The other person at that table, which your colleague Ray has mentioned a couple of times, is Elon Musk. Elon Musk makes over the majority of his electricity, Tesla money from China. And if that man is in Trump's ear and he is advising him on some of these picks, do you think Marco Rubio is going to be allowed to even start like that economic war with China? It shows you that a lot of these picks are there for presentation, not necessarily action on everything.
Well, that's a good point here. So Ray McGovern, I mean, anybody listening to this program might think, you know, these picks were because they are all pro-Israel and anti-Palestinian. But I'm almost sure that you'll agree that that's not obviously what credentials Trump looked at in order to pick them. So are we looking at the fact that we're just looking at loyalists, and these are merely, well, I don't know if I should say this, pawns that Trump has in his hands that he will get information from, but ultimately he will be the decision maker?
Well, it's actually, in my view, a distinction without a difference. Trump loyalists are ipso facto Zionists, just as bad as the chief Zionist, Joe Biden. You showed a clip of the Defense Department spokesperson there just a minute ago. It reminded me to point out a very critical factor. Our military, the U.S. military, and to an extent even the Israeli military, are showing some sense and some guts, some cojones, if you will. They stopped Trump from blessing Blinken's idea. I'm sorry. They stopped Biden from blessing Blinken's idea to attack further, deeper into Russia. Will they stand up now? I think the Israeli military is talking to our military and saying, look, we don't want any part of a war against Iran. And so I think our military, having shown its courage recently with respect to to Ukraine, would be prepared to step in and say, Mr. Trump, this is not going to work out very well. We've had very bad success. And besides, Iran has things like, they have things like the hypersonic missiles, which we're still trying to develop. They have the upper hand. They can destroy Israel. So let's not get mousetrapped by Netanyahu into supporting a war against Iran on false pretenses, which it would have to be, because Iran, in my view, doesn't want any part of a war with Israel or anyone else at this point.
All right. The Secretary of Defense pick is, I think, worth also talking about here, since we're quickly running out of time. Ashish, we're looking at Pete Hegseth, evangelical Christian, sees in Israel. This came out a couple hours back, so I put it in here. He sees in Israel the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, uses the Bible in support of U.S. Israeli genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. What does that mean, really? Is he really following that vantage point or approach that it made it in the news for me to come here and ask you that question?
I mean, a lot of Christian Zionists in America believe the biblical prophecy, right? They believe this evangelical trend in the United States, which believes that the Israelis need to settle that the entire Judea Samaria, and you know, the second coming will happen, and a third of Jews will convert to Christian, become Christian, the rest will die. I mean, if people who are Jewish and who are Israeli want to die on behalf of evangelical people in church in America, well, there's your ally, right? He wants to make sure you die to, you know, to fulfill a random prophecy in a book. So I would say with respect to him, he is probably someone that Trump feels like is tough because he's been on TV and has been a soldier. You know, he has a crusade quote on his body that he has shown a few times. I think the matter of the crusades was resolved 750 years ago when they were found that they were a really bad idea. So I do think hopefully there'll be generals and military professionals in the Defense Department who will give President Donald Trump better advice than this Fox News personality crusade reading, you know, obsessive Christian evangelical. I don't think he's going to give him any sound advice. It'll be the generals around the table that will have to weigh in. I would also add that, though, if you're looking at like his wanting to, you know, bomb the Middle East, it doesn't, again, hasn't changed with any other defense secretary we've had, right? Lloyd Austin has okayed all these weapons transfers, you know, predecessors before him in the Trump administration and even the Obama administration have been at war, if not through drones with peer personnel and missiles and bombs, than everyone before them. And this goes all the way back to Bill Clinton, right? Where in the first Iraq war, the Assistant Defense Department aggression towards people in the Middle East hasn't changed. One just has a crusader tattoo and the others are, again, a bit more professional, if we're going to use that term. Their ideology doesn't change.
All right, one last question. Ray McGovern, one is said to, if interested to find out what Trump's thinking is when it comes to West Asia in particular, is to look at the trade corridors. You're looking at that corridor that the Israeli Prime Minister talked about from India to Israel, Saudi Arabia through Israel, that will connect to Europe. And also we're looking at the gas fields off the Gaza Strip, for example. Trump is a businessman. Do you think that he wants a West Asia region that is filled with wars and destruction and devastation? Or does he want one that would aid him in fulfilling those trade route corridors?
When you talk about trade route corridors, you're talking about China as well.
And to undermine China.
China depends immensely. immensely on the availability of maybe about 20% of its oil from the Persian Gulf area. So what the new situation is that Iran has the equivalent of allies in Russia and in China. And so trade corridors, well, the ones that they want to protect are the Persian Gulf trade corridors. And what happens in the rest of the Middle East, particularly with respect to the gas deposits off Gaza, well, that's another matter that they're less concerned about. I would like to quote, let's close with one sentence quote from the UN senior human rights person who quit in October of last year, right after he saw what was happening. His name is Craig McKeiber. And what he says is relevant to this whole discussion because it started with genocide, it should end with genocide. If Israel, quote, if Israel gets its way with genocide, all the nascent project of the world governed by human rights and the rule of law crumbles. And then it's every person and every country for themselves. My God, that goes back to 1648,
okay,
before the Christians and before they stopped those wars in Europe.
Very well. We're going to end it on that. Ray McGovern, thank you for that. Former CIA analyst, Raleigh, North Carolina. Sheesh Prashar, former advisor to U.S. West Asia envoy from New York. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitagwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear listeners, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents and commentaries of chapter Qasas, the 28th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back with you after you listen to some of the verses of this chapter we're going to talk about in this program.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
إن فرعون علا في الأرض وجعل أهلها شيعا يستضعف طائفة منهم يذبح أبناءهم ويستحيي نساءهم إِنَّهُ كَانَ مِنَ الْمُفْسِدِينَ
Indeed, Pharaoh exalted himself in the land and made its people into factions, oppressing a sector among them, slaughtering their newborn sons and keeping their females alive. Indeed, he was of the corruptors.
Dear brothers and sisters, as you were with us, we were discussing the contents of the fourth verse of this chapter. إِنَّ فِرْعَوْنَ عَلَى فِي الْأَرْضِ. As you were with us, we together understood the very fact that how Pharaoh exalted himself in the land of Egypt. So, the previous verses were somehow the introduction to this part of the story. Now, what was Pharaoh doing? In order to strengthen the basis of his cruel oppression, he committed a number of crimes. So at first, he tried to produce disunity among people. He knew that the people who are together, who are united, cannot be defeated. And this was the same policy that had been forming the main foundation of the oppressors in the length of the history. So, the dominion of a little minority over a great majority is often impossible save by this principle of caste division and govern. So, he was aware of this fact. That's how he wanted to rule. That's how he wanted to gain control and power over the people. They have always been afraid of the unity of the word. They have always been afraid of the word of unity. They terribly feared of the close relation of the rows of the people with each other. This feeling of interconnectedness among the people. And for this reason, the only way of their protection is class government, the same thing that Pharaoh and the like have done in any age. So we have had different pharaohs. We are still having pharaohs that try to disunite the people, that try to bring and produce disunity among the people. This is how they try to gain power and control. They try to devise some plans, even in the very form and structures of the buildings and apartments, that people, although they're being close as possible to each other, but in feeling, in reality, they know nothing of each other. Because there are so many people of different classes, of different cultures, that cannot actually feel the feelings of each other. That's how they try to gain control. That's how they try to cast division and govern. And this culture that has been brought into our country from other ones, from other cultures, this is not the specific place to talk about, but this culture is a kind of culture that we can definitely explicitly see what kind of division it has in itself. Anyway, the verse continues saying, إِنَّ فِرْعَوْنَ عَلَى فِي الْأَرْضِ وَجَعَلَ أَهْلَهَا شِيَعًا. So, he divided its people into sections. So, Pharaoh divided the people of Egypt into two separate groups, Coptic group and Septian group. Coptic ones were the native people of that land, and all the governmental positions, all the means of comfort and castles and wealth were under their control, and Septians were the emigrant children of Israel who were in the grips of Coptic ones as slaves, as retainers and handmaiders, and poverty and deprivation had fully surrounded them. This is how he جعل أهلها شيعا. So, dear listeners, we said that Pharaoh committed a number of crimes in order to actually strengthen the basis of his government. So, at first, he tried to cast division. How exactly? جَعَلَ أَهْلَهَا شِيَعًا. He made the people, he divided people into different sections. So, there were one sections, I mean the ones who were the emigrant children of Israel. They were surrounded by poverty and deprivation. They had to be actually doing the most laborsome works without enjoying any interest, and there were these Coptic ones. So when we hear that for building a grave, such as the famous pyramid called Khufu, and to be located close to the capital of Egypt, Cairo, the kings of Egypt make 100,000 slaves work during 20 years, and thousands of them are killed in this event by means of, hard work, or because of pressure of doing, we may guess the whole things. We might just get a whole picture of what was going on. What was happening to the people of Israel. We'll talk more in the next episode about his other crimes. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Yours truly, as a soldier commissioned by yourself in this mission, upon completing the operation to liberate Abu Kamal, the last stronghold of Daesh, and lowering the flag of this American Zionist group and raising the flag of Syria, I announce the end of the rule of this accursed evil tree.
That was part of Commander Qasem Soleimani's letter to the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, announcing the success of his forces in defeating Daesh terrorist group and freeing their last stronghold. And today, the anniversary of this success has been named National Heroes Day in the country, in the loving memory of this commander, who was in the end assassinated by the U.S.
This is the nature of imperialism. Whoever stands in the way of their interests, they'll either try to buy him off or they'll assassinate him. Martyr Soleimani wouldn't be bought off with money. He wouldn't stray from his path with the promise of material gain. So, they decided to assassinate him.
The Daesh terrorist group, which was initially created by the U.S., attracted more terrorists in the region and mobilized them against countries that resisted the Israeli occupation.
Commander Soleimani successfully dealt a significant blow to the Western Front, particularly the U.S., as evidenced by numerous leaked documents from their own officials. For instance, during a presidential debate, Trump mentioned the role that Clinton played in creating ISIS.
She gave us ISIS as sure as you are sitting there. And what happened is now ISIS is in 32 countries, and now I listen how she's going to get rid of ISIS. She's going to get rid of nobody.
But American crimes went beyond the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Mohammad Reza Zahedi, another commander who had brought about the defeat of Daesh terrorists, was later assassinated by Israelis in line with the same policy. A crime followed by yet another assassination, that of Commander Abbas Nilforushan.
The Islamic Republic and the Iranian nation demonstrated unwavering resilience in their fight against the terrorist-natured war targeting the Muslim world. This conflict was part of a larger U.S. strategy, in conjunction with its key ally Israel, aimed at achieving their respective goals in West Asia. Israel seeks to secure its existential interests, while the U.S. aims to regain power and influence in the region. Given this context, maintaining vigilance is crucial.
For years, Iranians have raised their children ready to fight back. Their culture of resistance is evident in the many traditions and events held to revive the memories of the heroes of resistance on occasions such as National Heroes Day. According to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, such memoirs are more than personal stories. They are our national heritage. Preserving them helps empower our nation to overcome challenges. Therefore, as heroes battle and fall, Iranians are determined to keep their memories alive. Maryam Azarchar, Tehran.
On Wednesday, Washington voted down a resolution for ceasefire in the Gaza Strip at UN Security Council, while the other 14 members of the council voted in favor. The draft also called for release of captives held by Hamas resistance group in Gaza, but U.S. officials said the language was not strong enough as it did not condition the ceasefire on the release of captives.
We cannot support a resolution that calls for an unconditional, immediate ceasefire.
Following the vote, representatives of countries attending the Security Council session spoke out against the move.
If it were not for the repeated use of the veto by the United States or its claim that the UN Security Council resolutions are non-binding, the United Nations Security Council would not be so weak and ineffective.
For months, the U.S. has been confusing everyone and obstructing the UN Security Council efforts of developing a response to a catastrophic situation in Gaza, pandering to one side of the conflict in order to achieve its own political goals at the cost of Palestinian lives.
There's no justification whatsoever for vetoing a resolution trying to stop atrocities. No justification for that.
Iran also condemned the U.S. veto as disgraceful and said it reveals Washington's full contempt for innocent lives and peace. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said by vetoing the resolution, the U.S. once again demonstrated its direct complicity in the aggression against Palestinians. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad also called the American administration a partner to the genocide, an accusation that is even echoed in the United States.
What this extremist government has done in Gaza is unspeakable. But what makes it even more painful is that much of this has been done with U.S. weapons and American taxpayer dollars.
Sanders was speaking ahead of a resolution seeking to block the Biden administration's recent sale of $20 billion of weapons to Israel. However, with 79-18 votes against the measure, the Senate blocked passage of the resolution. The U.S. provides Israel with at least $3.8 billion in military aid annually, and the Joe Biden administration has authorized $14 billion in further assistance to the regime since the Israeli genocide began.
Representatives of the five member states of the Eurasian Economic Union, namely Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Armenia, and Kyrgyzstan, along with the chairman of Iran's Trade Promotion Organization and Iran's ambassador to Russia, held a meeting to coordinate the third exclusive exhibition of Eurasia in Iran later in February.
It's a very good field for cooperating between two countries, business of two countries, and actually we would like to thank the organizers of this event, and I believe that this platform will be the how can I say, good platform for cooperating and increasing our turnover between our two countries.
The Islamic Republic of Iran offers great potential as one of the major economic powers in the region. Our goal should be to pinpoint nations that we can collaborate with. The Eurasian Economic Union offers many opportunities, particularly taking Russia into consideration. Currently, Iran is serving as a hub for Russian goods.
Expo 2025 is a unique platform that can help introduce Iran's industrial capabilities and market opportunities to businessmen and industrialists of EEU member states.
Considering our strong historical and cultural ties with EEU member states, we can certainly benefit from the participation of Eurasian member countries in the upcoming exhibition.
The Eurasia Economic Union is the biggest union neighboring Iran. Both Iran and its member countries can make the most of the opportunities this union can provide.
Collaborating with the nations in the region is in accordance with the economic policies of Iran. The EU is the most important union in our region. The North-South Corridor is a strategic international transit route that can provide the EU access to the international waters.
Participants believe cooperation between Iran and the EEU can help boost Iran's economy.
The EU offers the opportunity to Iran to expand its business relations despite Western sanctions. Particularly in technical fields such as engineering, we can offer our services to these countries.
Iran has already signed a free trade agreement with three of the EEU member states.
The trade volume of the EU is approximately $900 billion. Iranian companies are hoping to benefit from a substantial share of this opportunity.
In line with its economic interests, Iran is currently looking forward to gaining observer status in the EU.
The Eurasia Expo 2025 serves as a platform for Iranian companies to present their capabilities, potentially leading to free trade with Eurasian Economic Union member countries. Mehdi Nourouzi, Tehran.
The Yemeni armed forces announced the targeting of Israel's military and vital sites in Tel Aviv and Ashkelon, striking areas deep within the occupied Palestine. Using a fleet of drones, the Yemeni military says the operation achieved all its objectives, underscoring its growing drone warfare capabilities. This latest strike has been described as a response to what Yemeni officials call injustices faced by the Palestinian and Lebanese people.
In the absence of other aerial weapons, the Yemeni armed forces achieved great success in using drones as a primary weapon. This indicates that the Yemeni army is able to prepare appropriate plans. The Israeli enemy is in a state of anxiety and terror, and sirens are blaring everywhere. Today, it is unable.
Ansarullah top official Mohammed al-Houthi did not mince words. Declaring the United States as weak as straw, he dismissed any potential return of Donald Trump to power as inconsequential, suggesting that U.S. policies are to remain unchanged. He also highlighted Yemen's victories over forces as evidence of their resilience, attributing these successes to faith and the teachings of the Holy Quran.
The Yemeni armed forces has carried out operations against multiple Israeli targets, including ships and cities occupied by the regime. And let's not forget the targeting of the Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier and warships, all of which are considered a qualitative leap, whether in obtaining intelligence or improving the weaknesses of the Western military technologies.
Meanwhile, the American National Interest magazine has echoed concerns about the vulnerability of U.S. naval fleets, citing Yemeni drone and missile capabilities as unprecedented challenges. Even the Pentagon has acknowledged the effectiveness of these tactics. This has left military analysts questioning the future of naval warfare in the region.
As Yemen steps further into the spotlight with its continued drone and missile operations against Israel and its backers, it's evident the dynamics of this conflict are rapidly changing. From the heart of Sana'a, the message from Yemen is one of defiance and determination. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
The relentless Israeli attacks continue to devastate the southern suburb of the Lebanese capital and started expanding towards the central areas of the city. After several days of relative calm last week, there has been a surge of over 50 airstrikes since Tuesday. These strikes, primarily targeting Dahi, have resulted in the destruction of entire buildings. The documented footage reveals that the weapons used were MK-84 bombs, which are US-made and weigh 1 ton. These explosives were equipped with US Joint Direct Attack Munition Guidance Kits, or JDAMs, allowing for precise strikes. The damage caused by the latest airstrikes goes beyond the targeted buildings and have caused damage to entire blocks and resulted in destruction on a large scale under the false claim of precision strikes. The regime has not presented any evidence linking the targeted buildings to military activity. Some of the buildings were even well-known public medical centers. This comes after some Israeli media confirmed that the War Cabinet agreed on increasing attacks on Lebanon. Lebanese journalist and security analyst Ali Jizzini commented on the latest developments.
The number of Israeli airstrikes against the capital city of Beirut on Dahi have increased significantly in the last few days. This comes within the framework of waging a psychological warfare against the Lebanese people, the people who support the resistance, to try to separate between the two entities. Also, it comes within the framework of the policy or the strategy of maximum pressure against the resistance and the Lebanese negotiators to push for terms that are more favorable to the Israelis. So since the Israelis are facing difficulties now in advancing on multiple axes in the south of Lebanon, and they're facing several problems, technical problems, problems that come with mobilization and the war exhaustion, they're resorting to choices that are cost-efficient for them, even if it means conducting air raids, terroristic actions, and actions that go against the international law.
Lebanese people are aware that these strikes aim to target public morale and that Israel is attempting to exert more pressure over the people, of which almost 1.4 million are now internally displaced. The Israeli cabinet, which seems incapable of achieving any of its political or military goals against the resistance in Lebanon, relies on destroying people's homes and stores in order to sell their settlers fake achievements. But since the missiles and drones of the resistance are still hitting Israeli colonies and military bases daily, it is not likely that anyone in the Israeli entity will buy it. From Lebanese capital Beirut, Hadi Hatib.
The strike aims to express solidarity with the Palestinian people and draw attention to the urgent need for action as the humanitarian crisis in northern Gaza intensifies due to the ongoing genocide and forced displacement.
I am on a hunger strike for 15 days, driven solely by a humanitarian cause. Our demand is clear. We urge the international community to ensure the delivery of aid to northern Gaza. To the people of Gaza, my message is simple. We stand with you, unwavering in solidarity.
The core principle behind our hunger strike is solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Gaza, who have been deprived of aid for 40 days. Through this strike, we share their pain, experiencing the very same hardships they endure. Our demand is straightforward: the delivery of aid to our brothers and sisters in Gaza.
As the strike enters its third week, the health of the hunger strikers has worsened, with a growing number of fainting cases and dangerously low blood sugar levels, prompting the transfer of some strikers to hospitals for treatment.
The health of those who began their strike 15 days ago, including myself and others here, has severely deteriorated. We are experiencing fatigue and weakness, relying solely on water mixed with salt. Some individuals have already been transferred to hospitals for medical care.
In the middle of famine and the starvation happening before our eyes in Gaza,
a group of guys, young guys and girls in Jordan start this hunger strike to support the Palestinian in Gaza and asking for support and need to save their lives in Gaza. Here in the Association Against Zionism and Racism, we are doing our duty to host this group of young guys and girls and support their standing.
Organizers report a surge in participation, with more youths joining in recent days. As the strike enters its third week, highlighting a growing interest among a broad segment of Jordanian youth to take part.
As the number of young hunger strikers grows, several movements have expressed support by providing them with headquarters. Their solidarity reflects a united Jordanian stance on the Palestinian cause. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Iran Radio. This is a new episode of Back to Reality. Thank you for joining us. This is Asma. I am very much honored to be here. And then, like always, we have two very dear guests, Brother Atta and Brother Muhammad Javad. So there's a ritual, and I would like you to introduce yourself very much briefly.
Thank you very much. This is Muhammad Javad, and thank you for having me in the program. And, I'm a PhD in applied linguistics.
Okay, assalamu alaikum. I'm Brother Atta. Very happy to be here. I've got my PhD in media management.
Well, that's amazing. So we're going to have very beautiful discussion today, I guess. So we are going to talk about the devil, and we have two sides of the devil, the linguistics and the media management.
Okay.
If we want to define our life, we always have our own perspective. If you are about to sum up life in only some sentences, what will you say? Generally,
okay.
When you hear the word life, what would come to your mind as a connotation?
Mm-hmm. Okay. First of all, lots of energy.
Yes.
Then happiness, mm-hmm. prosperity.
And do you, Brother Muhammad Javad?
Life, as my brother said, actually, it's full of energy, enthusiasm, dynamism. And somehow the opposite might also cross my mind, like
for sure.
Death, for example.
Yeah.
Or whatever is actually engaged in life as this kind of journey that everybody takes mm-hmm. from birth to death. And of course, I might add that the death is not the end, for
sure.
Those people who at least believe in
the hereafter.
The hereafter or the other realms of existence, basically, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. So now, based on your definitions, and I'm sure if we ask the audience about their definition of life, there is no place for the devil. But the question is, why do we accuse him so much?
Accuse devil?
Yeah. For everything. Like, for everything that happens in my life and I'm the wrongdoer, I would say, okay, it wasn't me. It was the devil. It was him who tempted me into doing this. It was him who encouraged me to this. It was by his aid and abet that I got into this.
Mm. First of all, I should say, mostly I accuse myself, not mm-hmm. devil, of doing wrong. Because
deep down, really, you accuse yourself?
Deep down, really, I accuse myself, not Satan.
So you're a very just judge.
Yeah, I do. He's doing his work in a proper manner. But deep down, I really accuse myself that this is me who is doing this wrong action.
Mm-hmm.
Or on the other side, if I do a good action, who am I going to, it's better to say, praise? Am I going to
you
praise
yourself?
Someone? Yeah, me, myself, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this is my free will. This is my free decision to whether do an evil action.
You don't accept that there is a temptation.
There is a temptation.
Yes,
there is a temptation. But the case is that the problem is not with the devil. It's not with the Satan or Iblis. He's doing his work. He has been created for this.
But he's so good at his work.
I think he's good because this is a promise of him,
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And this has been the promise that he made to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in order to deviate the people as much as possible.
He said
he said
to God in that kind of conversation or dialogue that he had with God, mm-hmm. that everybody knows, of course, at least those who are familiar with the discourse or the literature which is available in the religious tradition, that he would actually deceive. This is what
it's
he
a promise.
Claimed.
Yes, he has.
He would
promise.
Deceive everyone except
the righteous
the righteous ones or mukhlasin.
Yes, yeah.
This is what is actually indicated.
The one who are there for the battle full-heartedly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now, as for me,
okay.
Sometimes it happens that when something wrong happens, I can't help but thinking of the fact that, okay, how the world would have been mm-hmm. if there was no devil. Mm-hmm. But then, in order to get more into the depth of the answers, we go for a break and then we'll be back.
Okay. All right.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
There is a work of art, a long poem, by William Blake about the marriage of hell and heaven. Mm-hmm. And in there, if you dig deep into the words of the poet, you would get that we shouldn't look at life as this binary opposition of devil and angel. Sometimes, or let me just rephrase my word, it's the fact is that both of them exist in me. So it's me, the one who's going to pick it.
Mm-hmm.
So the matter is not the devil, but then we cannot help it, as I said before the break.
Okay.
We cannot help but accusing the devil for this. Mm-hmm. And it would happen in the hereafter as well. Like when I'm going to be facing the things that I have done,
yes.
I would actually point my fingers toward the devil and say, mm-hmm. it was him, it was his temptation, it wasn't
true.
Me.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we see that in many movies as well, like in many movies, in many novels, in many stories. Like sometimes I do something as if it's not me.
Mm-hmm.
It's the devil inside of me.
Yeah.
It very much reminded me of the same sense by the late Allama Tabatabai in a pamphlet called the Risalatul Velaya, which is on the mysticism, usually the Islamic Shia mysticism, says that do not look for the chastisement or reward in the other world. Both of them are with you in this
exactly.
world. So. This is exactly the godly aspect and the satanic aspect. I mean, the dimensions of your nature, of your fitra. Of course, fitra was born without evil at the first
instinct.
Beginning.
Instinct. How would we just translate fitra?
Maybe innate nature or something like that. Instinct, of course, is ghariza.
Or essence, maybe.
Or essence, maybe,
the essence of our existence.
But ghariza is very different.
But there is a very good, actually, technical jargon for this. And I've been working on this, like, mm-hmm. for a very, very long time. And I've been checking it, actually, with lots of native English speakers. And what we came up later, of course, I checked it also with, American philosophers like, for example, Hajj Muhammad Legenhausen, you mm-hmm. know, although he didn't accept it, we kind of agreed to some of the characteristics that is somehow in line with it. And we came up with theomorphic nature.
Yeah.
Theomorphic nature.
Yeah.
Theo,
right. Okay.
Actually referring to God.
Yeah,
this
right.
is something which comes from the divine source, and
right.
then morphic, it's somehow
the shape.
Yeah, the shape, and nature is basically the nature of everything or the essence of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So this, this is nature which is godlike, isn't it?
Yeah, godlike or divine nature or
right.
something like inherent in all human beings.
So I mean, there's no place of Satan or devil in that theomorphic nature, isn't it?
No, we are talking about fitra. Fitra
uh-huh,
is not.
It's not satanic.
It's not evil.
Okay.
Right?
It's not evil.
It's something which is like very much tilted toward spirit.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference between
right.
soul and spirit. You know that, right?
It's not related to whether you are born now. I mean, this fitra was born
with us since birth.
Since birth?
Yes.
Okay.
Theomorphic nature. We are talking
okay.
about that. We are not talking about that one whole or complete
fitra,
soul.
That's right. Okay.
Soul. No. We are not talking about
and
that.
And there's
right?
no satanic input in it.
No.
No.
Nothing.
Even if
evil inclination.
Your parents
in it, right?
are satanic or with satanic temptations, it's not going to be blow up to you, to your soul when you are born.
No.
No.
Well, but this question that you actually raised and directed to us is somehow a very profound and philosophical type mm-hmm. of one, you know, although it sounds very simple, mm-hmm. right? When you say, for example, whether Satan doesn't exist, and then if this hypothetical situation or scenario is taken into account, then we would have to look at this scenario from, you know, various perspectives, multiple facets and dimensions.
Yeah, it would make it even more difficult, because right now we feel like, okay, there is